Now, Helena, Ladakh is a province of India. It's located in the Western Himalayas. Some people may not know of it. I guess it's been referred to sometimes as a Shangri-La kingdom, even. How did you come to spend time in Ladakh, and what drew you to spend time there?
Well, actually, I was working as a linguist in Paris. I'm sort of Swedish, English, German, and had ended up studying languages and linguistics. And I was asked to go out as part of a film team to this remote, completely unheard of region. It's a part of Tibet, really, culturally. And I was quite interested, but I hadn't known anything about it before, so I just went along to help do the sound in the film, and very importantly, they wanted someone who could pick up a little bit of the language to help facilitate making the film. And that was because the whole area had been closed off completely to the Western world, and so it was really unknown and mysterious. And when I arrived there, I just found, yes, a type of Shangri-La. I really did. I found a place that was far wealthier than anything I had seen in the so-called Third World. And most importantly, I found people who were more self-respecting and joyous and full of vitality than any people I'd encountered. And I had traveled quite a lot. So I fell in love with the place and then decided to stay to work on the language.
When you say wealthier, I guess you don't mean in material wealth necessarily.
I do mean in material terms. I mean both in spiritual, psychological, and material terms. They were far wealthier than what I had seen in the so-called Third World. And I mean, I arrived and found that the houses were large and often three stories high, painted white, beautiful architecture. The women had exquisite jewelry, gold, silver, pearls, coral, turquoise, all of which showed real wealth because that had been traded with from the outside. The people hadn't known hunger. They'd never heard of anyone dying of hunger in living memory. So that is a material standard of living that was far higher than I had thought possible without modern Western industrial progress. So it completely changed my thinking about the world and about poverty, about where it comes from, and it also gave me a glimpse into a possibility of structuring our economic development in a way that would allow more people to have really rich lives, both materially, socially, and spiritually.
I was looking at your book again, Ancient Futures, and there's a quote in there from Major Gompertz, writing in 1928 in Magic Ladakh, "I wonder Mr. Gandhi did not go up to Ladakh. He would have found here nearly all his heart craves." And yet you were amazed at how life could be sustained in such an extreme climate, a very barren land, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, this is what makes it even more remarkable. People had adapted to an ecosystem that I think we could say is probably one of the harshest, most difficult environments in the world. A desert at about 12,000 feet elevation, surrounded by high mountains, snowed in for 6 to 8 months of the year. And in this barren, cold desert, people had, I suppose, had to learn that resources have limits and that we prosper if we learn to really look after those resources and work with them rather than squandering them. So, yes, I think what I found was something that was very, very close to Gandhi's ideal of relatively self-reliant villages. And yet, for me, it's also fascinating to see that there was trade. I mean, there was trade at every level, you know, within the village, between villages, in regional trade. But I think the big difference was that it was on the terms and in the hands of the local people rather than either huge anonymous governments or big corporations.
I'm interested in the aspect of daily life there. You were noticing a lot of interdependence, weren't you? A lot of harmony.
That's right. I mean, it can sound incredibly romantic, and so I really, I I find it very hard to really express it in a way that does it justice and that doesn't, you know, leave people with the idea that these people were some kind of angels or saints. They weren't. The more I live there, and now I have been going back for 30 years, and I've seen huge changes with the advent of the modern economy and so on, and I think I do have a pretty clear perspective. Obviously, it can't be totally objective. But yes, what I saw was that in that way of life, reciprocity and helping one another was so clearly something that was mutually beneficial. So it wasn't actually altruism in the sense of helping someone without any sense of having it returned. Because people were living in more community structures and had long-term relationships with each other, I saw that they were, you know, they realized that helping the other was the same as helping themselves, that in one way or another it would return. It wasn't sort of tit for tat, you know, immediately, you know, I help you out and then you've got to help me out. But there was that knowledge that you were living in a community where you would get help when you needed it. And it was it was absolutely wonderful to see how well it worked. I suppose particularly what strikes me, you know, when I look at how many Westerners in my sort of lifetime, how many people I've known who've dreamed of living in smaller villages, closer to the land and with community. I think one of the things that we weren't aware of was the need to have a critical mass of people. And what I mean by that is, you know, there were a lot of people who moved out into communes, communities, eco-villages, with too small a number to really fulfill all the various tasks that are needed. And it became very hard. Whereas what I found in Ladakh was that something like growing grain, enough grain to last you for the entire year, and so you even had stockpiles of it and you could make lots of beer out of excess grain and so on, it's actually very, very easy if you have the right ratio of people involved at the peak seasons. And the actual planting season and then harvest season are relatively short. But at that point, you need lots of help and lots of labor. And Ladakh has got that through institutions of collaboration and exchange. You know, they actually had sort of network structures of relationships that meant that they shared that labor and made it easier for everybody.
One of the things that seemed to have impressed you most over your 16 years there was just how the country changed. You said that you were there when the country started to open up, and I guess you were there to witness that firsthand, weren't you?
That's right. Actually, you say 16 years because that was at the time that I wrote the book, Ancient Futures, but of course now I've been there for 30 years. The sort of opening up of change to the outside world really started almost as I arrived. You know, I was one of the first outsiders to visit the region. And I think if I hadn't learned to speak the language fluently, relatively quickly, I probably wouldn't be saying, I wouldn't have realized a lot of things that I did through speaking the language fluently. Because in doing so, I can really say that in the early years, I experienced people who had the most remarkable high level of self-esteem, tolerance of others, which I now realize were linked. If you have self-respect and if you've grown up feeling really loved and supported as a child, you develop a tolerance and security and even love for yourself that allows you to be more tolerant and loving and accepting of others with all their frailties and problems. And I saw very, very clearly how the pressures from the outside had a psychological impact of making people feel insecure, making the young in particular feel inferior, feel that their way of life was somehow primitive and backward, and this mythical Western world was one of constant glamour and leisure, infinite wealth. It was so powerful and so seemingly successful that people lost respect for their own way of doing things, as I say, particularly the young. And I, so those psychological changes I saw happen in a very dramatic way. And I saw that with that loss of respect for their own culture, for their own knowledge systems, for their own everything, their own language, their own clothing, their own architecture, I saw that that rejection came out of this sense of inferiority. So I think that has made also the work that I've been doing there quite unique, because we've been working to try to redress that really mistaken notion that the West is perfect and that we have nothing but leisure and wealth and, you know, everything is perfect. Because that image of perfection is what makes other people feel imperfect. So I realized there was a huge information gap and that I could play a role in providing a fuller picture of what development had brought to other parts of the world, and particularly I could bring information about what was going on in the West.
Are all types of development, though, necessarily bad? I mean, do you argue against technological change?
No, you see, what people really don't understand is that today we have got but one model of development. And I think that 99.9999% of the activity that goes on under the name development is actually very destructive. And it's in part because it is everywhere contributing to the creation of a consumer monoculture that is so unsustainable and so unjust that it's leading, literally everywhere in the world, is leading to a dramatic widening in the gap between rich and poor. And I mean everywhere. I mean in my native country of Sweden, I mean in Mongolia, I mean in Ladakh, every country. You won't be able to name a single country where the gap between rich and poor isn't widening. Now, that is not an inevitability. And it's not some kind of natural phenomenon. It's not some kind of evolutionary process. It's because of very specific institutions having global reach. And I'm talking now in particular of the World Bank, the IMF, and the trade treaties. The GATT was one of the earlier forms of this, and now with the World Trade Organization. And this process is being pushed by the US government and the UK government. That process is leading to one form of development everywhere. Having said that, I reject completely this one dominant form of development does not mean that I'm opposed to development, to technological change, to cultural change, to changes in ecosystems. What I think we need to understand is that the flowering and maintenance of diversity is essential for life to continue, for real sustainability. So what I am working for is the understanding